Hey everyone, it's Jonathan Silva with the Lazy Dog Podcast, episode 23. Today I got to, or a couple days ago, I got to interview writer, producer, editor, director, but mainly documentarian, Adam Schell. Now Adam Schell has a movie coming out later this year, well actually later this month, March 20th, hopefully, called Pursuing Happiness. He tries to find the meaning of happiness, and why are some people happy? So before we get to his interview, I wanted to ask you guys, are you happy? And why are you happy? You know, you can break it down. You could be happy because you work, or you could be happy because you have a roof over your head. You could be happy because you have food in your fridge stocked up so you can eat something tonight, tomorrow night, and the rest of the month. Are you happy because of the people you surround yourself with? Are you happy because you're married to that one person, or are engaged to be married to someone? Are you happy because you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend? Are you happy because you have kids? Are you happy because of your environment? Or are you happy because you think you look good, your vain, smug person, you? Are you happy because you make a certain amount of money? They say money doesn't buy happiness, but money buys comfortability, and being comfortable makes you happy. So why are you happy? Are you happy at this moment? Probably not. You're listening to me when you could be doing something a lot more productive. But are you happy? At this point in time, are you happy? Have you been getting the cards you've been wanting to get dealt? Are you happy? I'm happy. I may not be surrounded by the people that I want to have surrounded by me. I may not be comfortable in my environment. I may not be making the money that I want to be making. But I'm doing what I love to do. I love to watch movies. I love to review movies. I love to write. I love to make video. I love to make movies. I could be happier, of course. Anyone could be happier. Or anyone could think that they could be happier with more, with excess. In the movie coming out March 20th, you have people there who are broke, who have nothing to their name, who are dying, and they are happier than anyone else in the world, or in America at least. They are unequivocally happy. And why is that? Why is that? Have they made their peace with their God, the person that they pray to? Are they happy? Because they know that this is the best life can get. Or are they happy because they surround themselves in an area that they are comfortable with, that they know what they can expect out of life come tomorrow or say next week? My grandparents live, you know, paycheck to paycheck. There's nothing in there for them to splurge. One week from now, and hey, let's go to Hawaii. They don't live like that. They live frugal. They get the money from wherever they get it. They use it to pay their bills. They're happy, or at least what they show me. Or at least what they put on their facade is happy. Do I want to be like them? To a certain extent, yeah, of course you always want to be molded by the people you grew up with. But I don't want to be like them. I want to be comfortable. I want to know that I have money in the bank to use when I want to and to use it when I need to. I want to be happy. That's the kind of happy I want to be. I want to be comfortable. I want to be set. So I ask you again, are you happy? tweet us at Lazy Dog Film Blog on Twitter, or find us on Facebook at Lazy Dog Films on Facebook. Or you can even drop us a comment right here on the website, Lazy Dog Films. Just drop a comment right underneath. Tell us why are you happy. And what can you do if you're not happy? What can you do to try to make yourself happy? Me, I'm happy right now, but I could be happier if I worked. I love movies. I love to make movies. Have I made a movie? No. Do I want to make a movie? Of course. Do I have the proper training? For all intents and purposes, yeah, I do. I have the training. I want to make movies. I was watching the Oscars yesterday and, you know, just watching it made me happy. Knowing that I could probably be in attendance one day at least made me even happier. At the very most, probably winning, but that could be far-fetched. Who knows? I can't see the future. I can only hope for what the future can be. And what I hope that the future can be is me holding up a golden statue, thanking my mom, and about bad-mouthing my father. But anyway, without further ado, here is my interview with Adam Schell, documentarian and director of Pursuing Happiness. Now, warning, before you start getting into the interview, it does sort of doesn't sound great, mainly because it was over the phone, so you will hear some background noises like the cars whirring by and a dog barking, but that is because of where I'm at now. But without further ado, here is my interview with director and documentarian Adam Schell.
Oh, great. Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's great.
It was fun. It was delightful. It was fun to watch. And then, I don't want to get into too much detail, but there's, I think, two scenes towards the end of the documentary that sort of had a lot of emotional weight to them. I'm mainly talking about not only Gloria, but also one of the better scenes in the documentary is with the gentleman who I forgot his name.
John.
The one who plays the piano towards the end.
Yeah, John.
He's
fantastic.
That scene is so great, and I like the way that scene kind of just goes on. There's no press in between it. It's just him enjoying that. Fantastic.
Yeah, that was one of those moments that, you know, I always tell people the documentary gods were smiling on me that day. Because there's that shot that right after he's done playing, and he gets up and he walks into the kitchen, and he wipes his you know, he's obviously crying, he's teared up, and he wipes his tears with that towel. And that mirror just happened to be perfectly placed. And, like, it just all worked out so perfect. And the funny thing about that moment was, you know, I shot the film on a Canon 5D. Mm-hmm. And the 5D only allows you to shoot in 12-minute increments. So every 12 minutes it shuts off and you have to start it up again. Mm-hmm. And I was right at that moment, I was approaching the end of the 12-minute run. And, you know, sometimes it goes 11:54, 11:55, and then it shuts off. Sometimes it goes 12:01, 12:02, and then shuts off. And I was right at that mark, and he walked in the kitchen. And you'll see that shot, as you watch that shot in the film, that shot plays as long as the camera was rolling. So it literally, I got just a couple extra seconds out of it that just made the timing work perfectly. So it was really one of those wonderful moments as a filmmaker that was just like, oh, that was so great.
And you can tell while watching it, it's sort of a prompting where, you know, you're holding the camera in this scene, where you were, or was it
No, we both had cameras.
Okay.
So that was the, that's how we made the film. We both had a camera in our hands at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So I was holding the main camera, the 5D, the one that shoots, that gets that shot of him playing and finishing and then walking into the kitchen, wiping his tears, and then coming back. And then it cuts away and it goes to the other camera that my producer was holding.
Okay. So before we get into talking a little bit more about the Let's talk a little bit of your background here. I noticed on your IMDb that you have a few documentaries that you filmed, Put the Camera on Me, and Yiddish Theater, A Love Story, as well as Finding Grassland. So what exactly is your background? I know you're a documentarian.
I am a documentarian. You know, maybe going to documentary filmmaking was really, it was kind of, I fell into it. The first film I made, Put the Camera on Me, is a film about myself and some friends that I grew up with. And one of my friends was an aspiring filmmaker since he was a kid, and his dad was in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
So he had access to a lot of cameras, and, you know, it's right at the dawn of video. And so his dad was in the post-production side, so he had all the cameras and all the stuff. And so as kids, we would take all that equipment and make movies, and we'd be all the actors and directors and everything. And so with this collection of movies that we made as kids, you know, beginning as just a kind of way to preserve the media and create a memento for us, we just started editing together that footage. And then, you know, it was like this little idea of, oh, let's, you know, shoot some interviews of us, like, talking about that experience and telling the stories that we'd always tell when we'd show those movies to friends and stuff. And it turned into this, you know, really cool movie that people, when they saw it, they just really got a lot out of it. And so that film ended up, you know, going to a ton of festivals and getting a distribution deal. And so that was kind of, you know, and it all started as just kind of like a, you know, something to do on the weekends and, you know, something for us. And so that's where I really learned filmmaking. You know, I just literally picked it up and just started doing it as a hobby. And I just loved it. I mean, I'm a musician. I'm a trained musician. And I've been, you know, playing music my whole life. And so that, all that knowledge of, you know, music and everything was really kind of paved the way for filmmaking, because, you know, filmmaking is all, it's all about rhythm. It's all about timing. It's all about, you know, all that same stuff that music has in it. And, you know, that's one of the things I love about it too, is it's not just one thing. It incorporates so many different elements. It incorporates, you know, it incorporates music first of all, and then it incorporates, you know, all the emotion and character and, you know, story and all that kind of stuff, which is why I really just took to it.
So you said you were a musician. What exactly what type of music did you play, or what instruments did you play?
I play piano, I play guitar, I play drums, and I'm a vocalist as well. And I write. I still do that.
Okay.
Not as much anymore, just because of time, and you know, filmmaking is so so taxing, and you know, there's so much in it. But you know, I've actually written some music for this film.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the version you saw though doesn't have that music. All the music in the version you saw is temp music. We're mixing it as we speak,
mm-hmm.
with all the final music and everything. So my music appears in the final version.
In the final version, it'll come out into late March, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you did this movie, Put the Camera on Me.
Mm-hmm.
After you start getting all this attention, you know, this getting distribution deals, what was your life like in terms of sort of shifting from music into filmmaking?
Well, you know, I never stopped making music, so it wasn't necessarily a shift out of one and into another for me. It was more of, oh, cool, now I have this other thing that I do too, that I love, you know? So it was more of just an expansion, and it was like, you know, and all my films, with the exception of Craftland, I do music as well. So it was kind of like an expansion for me into a broader spectrum of creativity and, you know, making art that, you know, I can share with the world. And that's what I love about it too, is that it brings in all these elements, you know? So really it was cool for me because I was able to do more stuff, you know what I mean? And create bigger pieces than just an album or a song or this, and not to belittle music in any way, of course. I mean, that's one of my passions as well, but that's what I love about film, is it has the ability to incorporate all those pieces.
How taxing is it for you to sort of juggle both in terms of in the middle of shooting one doc mixed with composing the music? Does that sort of, do you find the inspiration to write the music for the documentaries you've done in the middle of the documentary or after the documentary? Is there sort of something
It's weird. Inspiration comes in all different ways, and you know, when I'm making a film, I get so immersed in the process. You know, I get so immersed in the characters, and I literally watch the footage, each stitch of footage I've seen 10, 20, 30 times, you know, and I'm so immersed in the story, and I'm battling, you know, the ideas that were going on, and we're really, you know, formulating and going back and forth. And that's one of the interesting things about documentary filmmaking, is it's all made in the editing room. So it's you're editing and you're writing and you're rewriting and you're re-editing, and then you need to go shoot some more. And so you're shooting, and it's all happening at the same time. And so when I'm in that phase of creating this thing, the music kind of comes in a different way. So it's almost like music to me is a break from that brain space of making the film. I can just sit down at the piano for a couple hours and just play, and it's like a vacation for my brain, right? Mm-hmm. And other things happen that charges me in different ways. And, you know, I'll be thinking about a scene, and then I'll just sit down at the piano and start playing with that scene kind of rolling in my head, and I'll just start, you know, playing something and be like, oh, this is a great piece of music that would work well over that scene. So I'll, you know, pull up Pro Tools and I'll start laying down that music and then, you know, kind of working that in and all that kind of stuff. So it really does happen simultaneously for me. I like to go back and forth, you know.
Oh, okay. All right. For Pursuing Happiness, said it took you 2 years to gather all your materials, all your subjects, and then going out shooting it and editing it. I believe was maybe 2014, I think, the shooting finished? Am I correct on that?
Yeah, we finished in early 2014, yeah.
And the film was started in early 2012? Or late 2011?
Early 2012 is when we actually started. We did our first kind of like test proof of concept shooting in early 2012, just kind of like, hey, is this idea worth pursuing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we went out and shot a bunch of people and then started editing a few things together, and it just started, it was working, you know, it was a lot easier to find people than I had suspected,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then the people that I was finding had actually really interesting stories and were really fascinating people. And so that's kind of when we started, okay, let's now put all our eggs in this basket and move on and go forward with it.
And how much footage did you actually
see? Oh, we have probably 300-400 hours of footage all told. We shot over 400 people. So we have a litany of interviews and characters and edited sequence that don't appear in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the exciting things about this project for me is I feel like the film is such a small portion of the total that, I definitely have enough footage I can make a second film, or, I'm actually in talks with some people about turning it into a series and moving forward with it in that regard.
I would actually like to see that turn into a series. Each week or every few weeks, starting into sort of pursuing sadness.
Yeah.
The sadness and kind of play a role into our psyche in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, me too. Me too. I'd love to see that too. So, and it'll happen in some form. I mean, I've got all this footage, so it's definitely going to happen. It's just a question of how and where.
And the film's only maybe an hour and a half. I think they only had maybe 15 interviews with 15 people. I didn't count a lot in the film. It was sort of...
Yeah, there's about 15 people that appear in the film. There is an actual number that I have written down somewhere, people that appear in the film that I need to put into my brain. It's about 15 people with, I think, only about 8 main characters, so 8 stories that we really go into. And then there's all the other people that appear for, the commentary and the psychologists and the professors and all that kind of stuff. Jump in and out as well.
So what exactly did you take from it? I know you say that you have your speech at the end of the film, but what, looking back on it now, it's been over two years since the conclusion of filming. Has your thoughts changed on happiness since then, or has it remained the same?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting because going out on the road and meeting all these people and filming the film, getting all the footage and all that kind of stuff was so inspiring, and it was so uplifting because you're literally spending all your day is just meeting happy people. And it seriously rubbed off on me in a major way. And my wife even said it after one of the trips. She was like, wow, you're so happy. This is good for you. Keep doing this. And not that I was miserable and unhappy before necessarily, but it really did have this power. I could not, at that time when we finished shooting, I couldn't intellectualize that to you. I couldn't sit down and say, oh, here's what it is and here's why it is. It was just the power of meeting these people and connecting with them and being around them that was infectious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was basically the concept of the film. The concept of the film is, if I just put all these really infectious, happy people on the screen and tell their stories, with hope, the audience will feel that the way I felt it meeting them, and that will have a certain power on people to, hopefully inspire people to make some really, really great changes in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming back and editing the film, it's this long process of, like I said before, you have to write the film as you're editing it. So it's this long process of going through the footage, and it takes a while to get to know all the footage and understand what everything is,
mm-hmm.
And then figuring out the story and who belongs in and who doesn't, and trying, it's a lot of experimentation and, flipping it upside down and going back and forth and this and that. And that is the process for me that was really the intellectual part of learning about what the subject is, because I had to take all this footage and all these interesting people and put it together in a way that made it easy enough for somebody to come in and watch this in an hour and 15 minutes and understand what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so that's where, to me, the learning really, really happened. That's where I was able to take all these things of okay, I can go out and spend all this time with happy people, but as soon as I go back to my life and, I'm not necessarily around all these happy people, it fades really fast, right? Because you're not constantly being infected by all that. But once you kind of add the intellectual piece in there and you discover all the things that really are behind these people and really what makes them so happy in life, and the decisions they make, and the way they think about the world, and all that kind of stuff. That's where the power is, and that's when I learned the most, was kind of dissecting all that.
And how much of happiness do you think comes from comfortability within your own environment? You know, and you had the gentleman there who decided to be homeless, and he seems entirely comfortable. The woman whose son has essentially just a brain tumor that doesn't grow or recede, she seems comfortable in her life. Even the gentleman with no arms, he seems totally comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how much of that going in, were you comfortable going into the documentary? And if so, how do you think that changed your understanding of what happiness is?
You know, I think we all have this idea in our brains about what life should be like for us. You know, the things we want, our dreams, our desires, our goals, all these things that we hold out there in front of us and, you know, set these marks of achievement, right? And say, I want to get to X. I want to make X amount of money. I want to have this many accomplishments. I want to get married. I want to meet my wife. I want to have kids. You know, there's all these things that we put out into the future of places that we're reaching for. Mm-hmm. And those are what kind of keep you moving, right? They keep you motivated. They keep you pushing forward. But do they, in and of themselves, equal happiness? I mean, yes, there's certain levels of happiness that come from accomplishing your goals and achieving things, but life is what happens to you along that path, right? Mm-hmm. You're not always accomplishing the goal every day. You're not always accomplishing, you know, getting some big achievement. And so it's extremely important that, you know, you really cherish every moment. It's like, you know, I mean, like Gloria says, it's like you gotta really live in the now. It's like, I'm enjoying this moment here talking to you about this project and getting to know you. It's like, you have to really take all those moments in. And if you're constantly thinking about where you want to be and where you are and comparing those two and contrasting those two, mm-hmm. that gap is discomfort, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a certain amount of discomfort is necessary to keep you driven and keep you motivated, but you can only have so much of that before you start to get unhappy and uncomfortable. Just to answer the question is yes, and comfort has a great deal to do with it, but I believe that we all have the ability to create whatever comfort in our minds that we want. You know, we all have the ability to say, okay, I'm okay with the fact that, you know, X happened or Y happened. Like John says, I'm okay with the fact that I lost my arms. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I can't dwell on the fact that I lost my arms. If I sit here and dwell on the fact that I lost my arms, that's just wasting time. I'm going to get to living. What do I want to do? Well, I want to learn to fly a plane. I'm going to be the first double amputee to ever get their pilot's license with zero modifications. I'm going to learn to fly a plane just like everybody else. And yeah, I have this extra challenge, but so what? We all have challenges, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe John's mental capacity is a little bit stronger than the last guy, you know, who has two perfectly working hands.
Mm-hmm.
But John maybe understands better. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, you just got to put that into perspective and just, you know, the cliche is you got to choose to be happy,
mm-hmm.
right? You hear that a lot, right? And well, yeah, sure, that's easy. Yeah, just say to somebody, you know, choose to be happy. But you can't just sit there and go, okay, I choose to be happy, and then all of a sudden you're happy, right? You got to choose to be happy by making the choices along the way that get you there. And that's, you know, kind of one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish with this film was kind of giving all those little tips and tidbits about how to make those choices. It's like, which choices matter and which don't?
And do you still keep in contact with some of the people that you're interviewing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're spread out all over the country, so, you know, I don't get to see them a lot. But, you know, John, actually, talking about John, he just moved out to California last month, and I had lunch with him last week. And Sherry, David's mom, was just emailing with her last week, and then we got into this whole conversation that lasted like 2 or 3 days. So, yeah, I mean, I'm still in pretty close contact with most of the people in the film, actually, which is quite remarkable because, you know, I really do consider them friends, you know?
And did you expect having a sort of close relationship with some of the people that you've interviewed before going in? Is that something that you expected that? Or is it something that keeps you having to do
I mean, it was serendipitous. You know, one of the things about making a documentary film is you spend so much time with these people, you know, as in the editing bay, you know, and I'm sitting there watching. Now, granted, sometimes it's only an hour that I spent with them, but I'm sitting there watching them over and over again, slow motion, pause, back 2 frames, forward 3 frames. It's like, you know, I know every facial expression they make. I know how they, you know, push their hair to the side. I know all this stuff about them that, you know, sometimes you don't notice about people for years after knowing them in a real setting.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten to know these people on a level that they don't know me, you know? So automatically I feel a lot closer to them than they probably feel to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, unlike other films I've made where literally I've gone up to people who I've made films about or who are in my films, and I, you know, we spent, you know, 1-2 days together, whatever it was. And a year or two later, I go up to them and I'm like, hey, how you doing? And they're like, who are you? And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. You didn't spend the last year and a half with me. I spent the last year and a half with you. So, but this project in particular had something different. It was something special that people really gravitated towards and people really took personally, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have that experience with people in this film. They reach out to me and say, hey, I just want to see how you're doing. How's the film going? Blah, blah, blah. You know, what can I do to help? All that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, that's kind of a singular experience that's happened with this project, which is really exciting.
So it's a welcome change from
Oh, total welcome change. I mean, yeah, total welcome change.
For that, there's a level of intimacy that goes into editing film, especially with something that you've held metaphorically for so long. How hard was it to try to find the right pieces and the right beats in editing this, or finding the right pieces to fit within this good puzzle?
You know, that's always the biggest challenge. You know, when you make a narrative film, you know, it begins with a script.
Mm-hmm.
And a writer, whether it be, you know, the director or the actor, whoever it is, sits in a room and comes up with an idea and writes it out and fleshes it out and goes and goes and goes until they get a story. It's like, okay, this is good. Now let's go shoot. And then you make the film, you shoot it, and then you edit it to the script. Documentaries are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go out with a loose concept of an idea. You go, I have this idea for a film. Then you go out and you start shooting, you know, and then you come back and you see what film comes from what you shot. And so that's always the challenge, is finding that story and hashing it out and going back and forth. And the story you think when you're out on the road, you're like, oh my God, that was a great day. There was one day in particular that was like one of the highlights of our trip. You know, we met with this guy, Edwin, up in Davis, California,
mm-hmm.
who was just one of the really, really, really one of the happiest guys we met. And his segment didn't end up in the film. And not because he was boring, not because anything, because it just didn't fit the narrative. It didn't fit the bigger piece of the film. And that's, you know, one of the depressing things sometimes is like, you're like, oh, I love this guy and I love that character and I love that segment and what that brings. But in the big picture, it just doesn't fit. And so you really have to know, you have to be willing, you know, they always say in writing, you have to be willing to kill your babies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. You have to be willing to let go of some of your favorite stuff in order to find that narrative and to find that story and to make it cohesive and to make it enjoyable and watchable to get to the end goal of, you know, having a really great film. So, and listen, we did, that's why it takes so long to edit these things. Mm-hmm. You can't just dive in and edit it overnight because you got to sit with it. You got to let it bake. You got to stew on it. Then you got to walk away from it for a little while, then come back to it, watch it again, and then, you know, screen it for a bunch of people, get some feedback, then go back and tear it all apart and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we, one of my favorite experiences was we did the first screening we did for family and friends, just at a friend of mine's house. He's got a little, you know, movie theater in his house. So we invited, I think there were 10 people there, my parents, my producer's parents, and, you know, family and stuff. And everybody watched the film, and the reaction at the end was, this is great. This is really inspiring. You've got a lot of great characters. And people would lock on to the different characters, most of which are still in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of, like, talk about, oh, but here's, how are you going to make this work? And it was, and I was somewhat disheartened by that because I realized after that screening that the film didn't work. It wasn't good. I mean, it wasn't bad, but it just wasn't awesome. Mm-hmm. And so we went back and we tore the whole thing apart, and it was all about rearranging the structure and figuring out how we're going to tell this story. And we did it again about 3-4 months later. We did it again. And my producer's father is a good friend of mine and the subject of Finding Craftland.
Mm-hmm.
He said it, you know, at the end of that screening to the audience, he said, you know, I saw a cut of this film about 4 months ago. And of course I was proud of them. And, you know, it's my son. So of course I'm proud of what he did, but you know, that was kind of it. I walked away going, okay, they made the movie. Because this film is a completely different film. And now I have to say, I'm proud of this film more than I'm proud of just my son. And that's when it really hit me. I was like, we got it. We did it. You know, we made the film that, yeah, that was one of the most rewarding moments of this whole process.
Was there ever times when you guys felt, you know, a little bit unhappy with the process of how it was going, sort of not knowing where the film was going in terms of some of the things that you're shooting? Because I know after 400 interviews or 400 people that you've seen, I have to go in directions where, okay, I don't think this is where I want my film to be.
You know, I have to say that on this project, I never felt discouraged. Other than after that screening, I told you that one. My family was like, oh, yeah, good for you. I felt discouraged at that. After the first couple times we watched the film as we were putting it together, mm-hmm. I was feeling really discouraged because I knew what I wanted at the end of the day. And it just wasn't there. And it was really frustrating because I was so emotionally attached and involved. I mean, it never happened during the shooting because, you know, I always adhere to one principle when I'm making a film, and that is there are no bad ideas.
Mm-hmm.
There are no bad ideas. Follow every lead. Now, granted, you have to work logistics and budget and all this kind of thing, so you have to be smart about it, but follow every lead. If somebody says, hey, why don't you do this? Let's go check it out. Let's try it. Mm-hmm. And I do the same in the editing process because sometimes the worst ideas can lead to the best ideas. And so the shooting process was just fun. I mean, granted, we'd do things and it was like, yeah, I don't know how this is going to fit in the film at all, but you know, we're having a great time right now. You know, like we were in Oklahoma City, for example, and we met a lot of those city you know, government, and they took us on this ropes course that, you know, this was the winter time, so it wasn't open, but they took us out there and let us climb this huge ropes course. And we took our cameras up and we like rigged them to us so they wouldn't fall and everything. And I was like, I have no idea how this is ever going to fit in the film, but it's, we're having a good time right now. So that process, no, but definitely the editing process. I mean, that can be challenging, you know, when you just like, you know, you've got something great. You're like, we've got all this great stuff. There's that moment of John and there's Gloria and there's, you know, all this stuff. And that time we had a Brobridge and there's so much here. And it's just figuring out that puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And until you get it, you haven't got it. You know what I mean? And you got to keep going. You got to keep cracking at it, which was what I really did enjoy about this film is I did have time. I had time to let the process happen. I wasn't under the gun of, you know, a production company that was saying, hey, you need to deliver in 2 months. And then I would just give them what I got. I really did have the time to let this film come out and be what it is.
And if you didn't have sort of the backup that you had, your script on it, you think the film would have gotten made, or you think the film would have gotten made much longer, or be
Yeah, you know, it would have been different. It for sure would have been different. The film would have gotten made. I was making this film one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Kickstarter, it wasn't just about the financial help that Kickstarter did. I mean, granted, that was it. That's what got us, you know, our production budget. So, but it was really, you know, the community that we built. That's where all the people in the film came from, was getting out there and, you know, all through that campaign, all the social media marketing that we did to get people's attention to go and donate to the campaign also got us all the interviews, you know? So, yeah, it would have been a completely different film without that, because we wouldn't have had the community that we built.
I
was shooting a Canon 5D Mark III, and they doubled the length. So it's the new version, and you can get 24 minutes out of it now. I definitely love the format. I think the camera looks fantastic. I think it's easy to use. It's light. It's unassuming, you know, because it's a smaller camera.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I would definitely use it again. And you know, listen, we shot with two cameras. We also had another camera that's a Canon XF100. And so, be it that the cameras were, and audio was separate as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, even when the camera did stuff, and I got, you know, my rhythm was really good. So, I'd know, oh, I'm approaching the end of this clip, start it and stop it now while there's a break in the action or somebody's not saying something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's start it and stop it now so we get a longer runway. So, no, I don't see that as, it really, that was the moment with John was the only moment where I was like, concerned. You know, I think it depends on the person for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, money cannot buy happiness. It can't. There's a certain amount of comfort in life that money begets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the more money you have, the more stuff you have, the more things you have. And like Norton says in the film, there's a level, there's a limit. You know, as soon as you are comfortable in that, you know, all the basics are taken care of, your housing is taken care of, your, you know, your car, your transportation, your food, your health insurance, your all those basics are covered. You don't have to worry where the next meal is coming from.
Mm.
Then I think there is no relationship between more money and more happiness. there's more money and more stuff, but more stuff just means you now have to deal with that stuff. You know, anytime I get something else, it's like, okay, great, I got this new thing, but now I have to spend all this time learning how to use it or setting it up or building it or, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's more money, more problems, you know, is what they say. But, you know, I think, like Norton says, I really do think it's all about what you can get with that money. And I think happiness comes from experiences. I don't think it comes from things, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like I always say to people, I tell my parents this, you know, as they're getting older and they're retirement age and, you know, they're talking about, you know, what they're going to leave to me and my brothers when they die. I'm like, don't leave us anything. Spend it all. Go do things. You know, get out in the world. Go travel. Take that cruise you always wanted to take in the Mediterranean and, you know, do things with your money. That's what it's for, because life is about experiences. It's not about money, mm-hmm. you know. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know if you can see
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There was a great TED talk about just a TED episode about how the differences between different countries sort of trade.
Yeah.
Or think about money and different
Yeah. Yeah. Based on the language they use to talk about money, right?
Yeah. In terms of like China, Japan, they don't necessarily have a future tense. Yeah.
Right.
Right. We basically have a future tense. And languages like English have future tenses, so we're mostly like, you know, subconsciously we're like, you know, that's not going to happen to us for another 15 years after that. I think it's going to matter.
Right, exactly. I'll worry about 15 years in 15 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, our country is built on the idea of money, and we're a capitalist society. Everything is about money. It's all about money. Anywhere you go, it's like, what's the chief concern? The bottom line, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, we find ourselves in this place where the happiness industry is so massive and everybody, and there's so much information out there about happiness right now, because I think we're somewhat realizing that, you know, life isn't all about money. Yeah, we're the richest and most powerful country in the world, but we're not the happiest.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the goals of life? What is life about? What is living? Is living being rich or is living being happy? And they aren't the same, you know. And I think when you have a society like ours that's built around the ideas of money, it's certainly not built around the ideas of being happy. And so I think there's this false notion that gets put into things that is saying, well, what's the basis of our society? Our society's basis is money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's happiness. You know, I think it's just easy to equate the two, because I think intrinsically we all know life is about being happy and fulfilled. That's what life is really about.
Interview someone from some of the more happier countries. I think the top one is Finland, or
Sweden, Norway. Norway was number one when I started the film, and the stuff that appears in the film is Norway. So there's number one. But Norway, Sweden, Finland, all the Scandinavian, Denmark is up there. They're all up there.
Would you like to have an opportunity to interview someone from one of those countries and ask them what is happiness, what makes them happy?
Absolutely. You know, I would love, I mean, one of the ideas that I've always had is I'd love to take this concept and this idea on the road and travel the world and do this, not just, you know, and do maybe different segments where it's like, pursuing happiness in this country, in that country, in this country, and really get a good understanding of people around the world and how happiness exists in different countries. I would love to do that. I hope so. You know, the thing that makes me the happiest in life is connecting with great people.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to know people. It's like I always get charged up after I have a good conversation. Like, I'll be charged up the rest of the day after this. Just talking to people and getting to know people and hearing what makes people tick. I mean, people are the most interesting thing about this planet. And that's what charges me. Is getting to know people and having good connections with people.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to switch up to the interview and sort of answer some of your questions, some of the basic questions that you've asked on the interview?
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah,
well, so I'll ask you, I mean, what? Tell me about your life. What do you do? I mean, what do you do for a living?
I do this for a living. Entertainment blog that I've been running for a few years, and recently I've been trying to do what you're doing, expecting more knowledge of you. Hopefully, I'm going to be up for a cinematography job at Cedar Rising in Tampa.
Oh, very cool.
So I'm excited for that, you know, the possibility of utilizing our talents
That's great. And how did you get started in this the blog thing? What made you want to do this? Nice. That's awesome. And you're enjoying it? I mean, it's still work, right?
It's still work.
It's still work.
A lot of times, especially when I'm in the back, from a green screen.
Right.
That kind of temporary passing. But
right. The editing and stuff, yeah.
Exactly. But at the end of it, I'm so excited that somebody's going to watch one of my movies.
Yeah, it's very rewarding, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's cool. Where are you from?
Originally from New York, and now I'm in Central Florida.
Central Florida. What brought you down to Central Florida?
Family and college.
Family. Nice.
Nice.
Well, I'm in Los Angeles, in Studio City.
It must be so warm over there, I guess.
Warm is hot. Yeah, I think it's in the 80s. It might be more than 80.
That's not bad.
Yeah, no, it's not bad. We've been having somewhat of a hot spell lately. It was in the 90s last week, and yeah, it's warm here. It is definitely warm. There's no convincing me that global warming is not a real thing.
Yeah, here I woke up at around 4 in the morning to walk my mother to the car so I can have a little work. And it was 45 degrees out here.
Wow.
Fantastic.
And now what is it? What is it now?
60 maybe? 65?
That's great. 45 to 65, nice brisk morning like that? That's fantastic.
You have no idea. I had my window open with my fan on. I can't see from the top.
Yeah. Nice.
So, the film is coming out in March. When in March?
We're shooting for March 20th, which is the International Day of Happiness. We're initially launching with a Tug series. Are you familiar with Tug? They're an online... It's an online theatrical distribution platform that basically allows you to crowdsource screenings of a film. So it allows you to, instead of, you know, with documentaries, you usually get a limited distribution, theatrical distribution run. You know, you get like a couple weeks in the major markets, LA and New York, which we're looking into doing as well. But with Tug, it allows you to bring it to a lot of any market where, you know, there's a movie theater, basically. And so, because we have so many people that we interviewed in all kinds of different places that want to see the film and share it with their friends and communities. So Tug is the perfect platform for that, because you can just go online, say, I'm in Central Florida and I want to set up a screening. And you can go online, you can, you know, kind of sign up as a promoter and then pick your date and time in the theater, and then you know, it gets activated as a screening, and then a certain number of tickets sell to allow the theater to, you know, make enough money so they can do it. Then the screening tips, and then it actually happens. But there's like a certain number of tickets you have to sell to each screening to make it tip. But it's really cool, because that way we can have it screen all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to see the film is with an audience. I mean, it definitely plays well just watching it alone, but it also plays, it's really great to see it with an audience and get that communal response and get the energy and then the conversations that ensue afterwards and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And how can go into this and sort of set up?
Yeah, it will be live on Tug, I think sometime next week, or you can go to my website, which is probably the best way to do it, which is pursuinghappiness.com.
Okay.
And then the Tug links, and there's going to be a Tug specific video kind of explaining what Tug is and all that kind of stuff to guide you through it.
Mm-hmm. Before we get out, just a few more questions. Watching movies, it seems like you have this sort of Michael Moore sort of inspiration for the film, like you essentially being a character in it, and sort of halfway through, you sort of almost you withdraw yourself and let the film be the rest of the rest of the process. So who is your inspiration for making films like this?
You know, I would say I don't have anybody specifically that's inspiration for my filmmaking. I kind of just know what I want to see, and I kind of let each film be its thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, this film, I felt like that was one of the pieces that we struggled with in the editing process, was where do I fit in this film? Am I the main character? Am I a tour guide character? Am I not in the film at all? The first several versions of the film, I wasn't even in the film. It was just the people in the film. And then what we realized quickly was you need some sort of linchpin. You need somebody to go along with on this journey to get on the ride. There's so many different people that you're bouncing around. You know, you got to be able to follow one character and be like, okay, I know who I'm in this movie with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why, you know, big blockbusters always have, you know, the marquee players. It's like, okay, I'm going to see a George Clooney movie. I'm going to see a Brad Pitt movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what that was for me, is like, and I felt like the movie needed needed a lot of explanation of, okay, what is this? What are we doing here? So that was really the best way to do it, was, hey, listen, I went on this journey. I did this thing. I went out and met all these people. I talked to them. I had this experience with everybody. And so I felt like it was just best told through my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But I am in no way the Michael Moore type of filmmaker who says, it's all about me. Let me show you how great or not great, whatever you believe, I am.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, the film isn't about me, is my point. It's not about me. It's about the happiest people in America, and I don't claim to be one of them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you still need that linchpin of, you know, where am I, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it'll be, we're going to be doing a theatrical release in early April in LA and New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll also be available in May through educational platforms. And then in the fall, September, the dates haven't been set yet, but it'll be out on DVD and VOD.
Mm-hmm.
And the film will also be available through my website as well.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks for that. Before we go, you have sort of there's a lot of time between your previous background as you had. Were you in between put the camera on you and finding background?
Yeah.
Now with the background for this. Do you have another documentary in mind?
I have several projects. Yeah, I have several projects that I have in mind. I have a lot of ideas for new projects. The reason why my first films, you know, there's such a gap is because I had a full-time job for all those years. I ran a company, and so documentary filmmaking was kind of my side gig. It was the stuff I did on the weekends.
Mm.
So that's why there it wasn't like my full time. Now this is my full-time gig. Luckily I've been able to position myself to get there, basically. So this film will, you know, obviously is coming out now, and I will immediately begin work on my next film as soon as this is all wrapped up.
Well, thank you very much, Adam, for taking the time out to do this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.